Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Another step closer to ending right to work in the state of Michigan. Pilots at American Airlines setting a strike authorization vote. And today on the show, Glacier Northwest versus Teamsters Local 174, the lawyer who stood up for labor at the U.S. Supreme Court. And we check in with the North Coast Labor Federation. Welcome to the Thursday, March 16th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Darren Dalmut is going to be our first guest on the show today. He is an attorney, practices in the state of Washington, and he's also the attorney for Teamster Local 174. A little background on Darren. He's done a lot for organized labor. In fact, at one time, he was in-house counsel for the Service Employees International Union. He's done all kinds of litigation dealing with the Railway Labor Act, wage and hour law, represented a number of unions in bankruptcy cases. And back in October, he argued a case called Glacier Northwest versus Teamster Local 174. Very significant case. And it's not significant just for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, but for all of organized labor, because we're talking about the right to strike. Now, you do have a right to strike, but there could be a cost affiliated with that strike. Let me give you a little background on this case. First off, about 60 years ago, the Supreme Court held in the Garmin case that when an activity is protected by the National Labor Relations Act, the states as well as the federal courts must defer to the labor board, the National Labor Board, if the danger of state interference with national policy is to be averted. I know it sounds like a bit of gobbledygook, but here's the story. In 2017, 174, Teamster Local 174, based in Seattle, went on strike against Glacier. This is a cement mixing company. The strike lasted for about 8 days, and eventually they won a contract. Well, guess what? After they win the contract, the company said they should be allowed to sue the Teamsters in state courts for the losses they incurred after the drivers returned their mixer trucks to the company's care with the drums running, and then they walked off the job to begin the strike. Now, the strike is a federally protected and fundamental right for workers in the fight to improve wages, benefits, and working conditions, okay? That's precedent. Glacier later disciplined the drivers who had concrete in their trucks at the time the strike began and returned to the yard without delivering it to customers, leading 174 to file an unfair labor practice charge against the company. Despite the drivers' clearly protected strike conduct and the pending ULP charge against the company, Glacier argued that the local, quote, intentionally destroyed its property because the company was not able to deliver the concrete without its drivers and then ended up disposing it at a loss. Now, if the court, we're talking the Supreme Court, if the court were to agree with what Glacier is saying, employers could sue unions or individual workers for the ordinary an inevitable result of workers exercising their right to strike. Do you understand the significance of this case right now? Darren did a great job on this. The Teamsters nationally are watching this case. We should get a decision sometime, say, maybe the second or third week of June. So our first guest on the show will be Darren Dalmut. Darren arguing the case for Teamster Local 174 before the U.S. Supreme Court. Later in the show, we're going to check in with Pat Gallagher. Pat Gallagher of the North Coast Labor Federation, also the steelworkers. He's going to share some news about a contract recently reached for casino workers in two cities in the state of Ohio. That would be Columbus and Toledo. He's also going to talk about right to work, close to being repealed in the state of Michigan. Got some good news on that coming up. Also, the rail industry, all eyes on East Palestine, Ohio, because of that train derailment in early February. And according to the National Transportation Safety Board, that derailment was 100% preventable because of an overheated bearing. I've been reading a lot about these bearings on these trains, and when they get hot, there's sensors that indicate when they are at a certain temperature. And in this case, I believe they did get a sensor that showed it went from 38 degrees to 103 degrees, and then it jumped to 253 degrees in a very short amount of time. And keep in mind, the train is moving. I mean, you can't just immediately stop it. And by the time it got to 253 degrees, well, it was too late. It was too late. So now the company is saying, well, we need more sensors, and the sensors have to be more accurate. The attorney general for the state of Ohio is saying, you know what? There's too many of these train derailments going on. So he has filed suit against Norfolk Southern. I guess the incidents have gone up like 80% in a very short amount of time. So that's another issue. We're going to check in with Pat. And also the tariffs on steel and aluminum. This happened during the Trump administration. And the International Trade Commission released a report on this. And the ITC is not too crazy about these tariffs, but they are working. They are working. And the steel industry has improved its financial condition under what's called Section 232 because of those tariffs. In fact, there's new investments, over $15 billion in new investments, upgrades, and plant expansions have happened because of the tariffs. So we'll give you an update on that on behalf of Pat Gallagher and the North Coast Labor Federation. Now a brief look into the world of labor. This segment brought to you by Boyd Watterson Asset Management. You can find more at BoydWatterson.com. Well, the Michigan Senate approved a bill to repeal the state's right-to-work laws in a major victory for organized labor. The vote was 20-17. This happened Tuesday night along party lines. The Michigan Senate passed the bill to revoke the state's right-to-work law, sending it back to the state house for final approval. This is pretty typical because you got two different bills and there's language that's a little bit different. Once they agree on the language, it goes to the governor. That would be Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who said that she will sign the bill. Okay? That could take probably maybe a week, 2 weeks. Right now, there are right-to-work laws in 27 U.S. states, mostly in the South. Laws have been credited with the dramatic decline in union membership and growing income inequality. Well, on Tuesday night, hundreds of union members piled into the Michigan Capitol to cheer on the bill. Liz Shuler, president of the AFL-CIO, tweeted on Tuesday night, "This is what happens when we elect union members to the halls of power. We fight and we win for working people." Now, I have to say, this is a rare occurrence. In fact, the Economic Policy Institute, great organization, epi.org, they said if Michigan Governor Whitmer signs the bill into law, Michigan will be the first state to repeal a right-to-work law in nearly six decades. Missouri voters overwhelmingly shot down their own legislature's right-to-work laws in a 2018 ballot referendum. We covered that case extensively. So it's certainly good news for organized labor. And you know what's really good about this? The Washington Post picked up on this story, and that's a national newspaper. We want to make sure that these anti-union folks realize, you know what? Labor is back. Labor is back. We're not taking this lightly. We're going to change the political makeup in the legislature, and we're going to get rid of right to work. And they're going to restore prevailing wage. That's another issue here. Now let's go to the state of Montana, where nearly 400 workers packed the halls of the legislature, giving testimony to the House Business and Labor Committee against right-to-work legislation. This started in January. The committee heard testimony from about 100 workers about how Their collective voice on the job protects wages, benefits, safety, and local economies. Well, guess what? The legislation died in committee the next week, thus signaling the strength of Montana's labor movement and the organizing efforts of every union in the state. Hats off to the locals there. Jim Holbrook is with the IBEW. He's the executive secretary of the Montana State Labor Federation. He said workers across Montana want their quality of life and voice on the job protected. Right to work legislation is an attack on all the workers who built our great state. We have seen the disastrous fallout from right to work legislation in other states. During this legislative session, we have fought and won by letting this legislature know that workers are the economy and our rights must be protected. Amen. Yeah, we've been covering Montana the past couple of years on this, and it never ceases to amaze me. Lawmakers, after what happened again and again and again, they still keep trying to bring back right to work. Meanwhile, American airline pilots have set a strike authorization vote. This is for next month. The vote follows Delta Airlines pilots ratifying a new contract earlier this month, which includes $7 billion in total pay and benefit increases. American Airlines executives have expressed a willingness to match the pay increase from Delta in their own contract negotiations. And one more here on behalf of the AFL-CIO. They're pushing for the Paycheck Fairness Act, which increases penalties when employers violate equal pay provisions. You may recall yesterday we were talking about Equal Pay Day, which was 2 days ago. It was on March 14th. And women pretty much make about 80% of what a man makes. And it takes about 73 days for a woman to catch up in the new year to make the same salary that a man made the last year. So that's what the Paycheck Fairness Act is all about. So if you want to go to AFLCIO.org, there's a petition there to push for the Paycheck Fairness Act. And over the course of time, if a woman is working, you know, say 30, 40 years, we're talking about $400,000 difference between a female and a male. AFLCIO.org for more information on that. All right, a quick break when we come back. Darren Dowman arguing a case for Teamster Local 174. We're talking about the right to strike. That's coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
Hello from the Communication Workers of America, District 4. We are a labor union representing a vast array of workers in different industries, including the Association of Flight Attendants, Telecommunications, CWA Passenger Services, Public Health Care, and Education Workers, the IUE, CWA Industrial Division, the National Association of Broadcast Employees, the CWA News Guild, not to mention our growing digital sector, and many others. If you're interested in organizing your work group or learning more about what it means to be CWA strong, visit our website at www.cwad4.org. That's cwad4.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to Washington State right now, and joining us on our live line is Darren Dalmat. Darren is an attorney, and it's not too often that you have an attorney that can argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, he's done that. He's also argued before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 3rd, 4th, 6th, 7th, and 9th circuits, educated at Columbia Law School, got his bachelor's at Yale University, also a super lawyer's rising star. And he had the distinction to argue a case for Teamster Local 174 outside of Seattle, Washington. Darren Dalmat, thank you for joining America's Workforce. And I tell you, I got a lot of questions for you today. But first, I want to elaborate a little bit more on your background. I see you you did some work. You were in-house counsel for the Service Employees International Union, also co-counsel of the Public Justice Center. It sounds like social justice is in your background. Can you speak to that? How did you go in that direction, Darren?
Sure, and it's good to be with you here. So I went to law school, and I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do at the time. I did a lot of work on prisoners' rights. I did work on voting rights, and the other main area of interest I had was economic justice, which has become my life's work. And at Columbia, I was very lucky to sort of get hooked up with a group of students who were labor activists and were involved in organizing and negotiating campaigns for unions on campus. And so that was an introduction I had to the world of labor. I grew up in the South in Atlanta, Georgia, and wasn't so familiar with labor back then as a kid. And so mm-hmm. It was really in law school that I had my first exposure. And as you noted, my first job out of law school was, I was very lucky to get a job with SEIU and their in-house legal department, and that really opened it up for me.
You know, I wish I got connected with you sooner, because I also saw in your bio that you were connected and did some counseling regarding the Railway Labor Act, and we had almost a rail strike last year. So I'm sure that caught your attention. And I know there's some members in Congress that still want to get that in the right direction, especially with the paid sick leave, which is unfortunate. And that whole industry needs more attention than it's getting. But let's talk about this this Glacier Northwest case. How did you get involved? Now, were you working with 174, Teamsters 174? And is that how it started or what?
Yes. My law firm, Bernard Glitzen and Lavitt, has worked with Teamsters 174 for decades, and so my partner Dimitri Glitzen was advising the union on the strike. This was back in 2017, and at the time, you know, we thought it was just a garden variety strike. We were coming out of the recession, you know, from the last couple rounds of contracts, which were concessionary, and workers were fired up to make some advances for the first time in quite a long time. And progress wasn't going the way they wanted to in negotiations. And so, as is typical when that happens, they were fired up and they went out on strike, and we helped advise them on how to do that in what we thought was a responsible way. And so we were pretty shocked, when we got a lawsuit over it. We thought it was just so out of the ordinary, seeking damages for the normal consequences of a strike. And here we are 5 years later, having it gone all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which we never expected.
When you talk about damages, can you be specific on that? Because there's physical damages, there's economic damages.
Sure. So in some ways, I can't be super specific because we won those claims so early in the state court that we never got to the point of the lawsuit that we got to ask them questions and have them sort of itemize it. But I can tell you what they asked for in their complaint, and what they asked for in their complaint was a combination of the value of the lost concrete. So these were concrete mixer truck drivers who went out on strike and they returned their trucks to Glacier. And some of the trucks had mixed concrete still in it. And so by our calculations, that was about $11,000 worth of sand, gravel, and cement. And this is a company whose parent company has something like $8 or $9 billion a year in revenue. So it's a tiny, tiny, tiny drop in the bucket. But they sued us over the lost concrete. They sued us over cleanup costs that, you know, they broke up the concrete after it hardened and had it hauled off a week later. And then they also sued us over lost profits associated with not being able to deliver the concrete to the customers, although they've kind of hedged throughout the litigation, because even they, their lawyers recognize that lost profits are just so squarely within the heart of strike damages that ordinarily, up until now, unless the Supreme Court changes the law on this, that would not be something that a company would be able to get. So they've kind of gone back and forth on that one.
What kind of money altogether are we looking at? Did you tabulate that number that they're seeking?
No, because we didn't get to the the fact finding part of the case, because we won it on the face of the complaint at the very first stage of the litigation. So we didn't get to a point where we forced them to cough up a number. But you know, I would be shocked if it were more than $100,000, for everything. And when you compare that to the amount of legal bills that they've spent, you know, in 5 years of litigation, including hiring Noel Francisco, the former Trump Solicitor General, to represent them, I'm sure they've way outspent even the biggest amount of money that they could conceivably claim, which just shows that it's a purely ideological suit from our perspective.
Well, they obviously wanted to make a statement here. So now, in the normal course of things, since you represented 174, did you know that you would become the person to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and argue this case? I mean, all along, you're thinking, okay, we'll get this done. And the next thing you know, wait a minute, it's going one step further. It's going another step further. All of a sudden, you're in Washington. can you talk to us about that journey?
Yeah, it was pretty shocking. We won it at the trial court level, as I say, on a motion to dismiss. So for the non-lawyers out there, that's the very first step of a case. You say, hey, this complaint doesn't even make out something that's a legal violation. Like, it's just a nothing. And so the court shouldn't even get past step one. And so that's how early we won it in the trial court. And then the Washington Court of Appeals reversed it. So we lost 3-0 there, but then we took it to the state Supreme Court and we got a 9-0 victory from the state Supreme Court. And we thought, hey, that should be the end of the road. Usually when the U.S. Supreme Court gets involved, it's because there's a division among states or a division among federal courts about what the law should be. And there's nothing like that here. The relevant law, which is called Garmin preemption, that's the legal speak for it, but it's basically about the relationship between federal law and state law, has been clear for more than 60 years. And it's not like there were courts that were going off on a wrong direction. So there is no good legal reason for the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case. So we were pretty shocked when we learned the first week of October that they decided to take the case. And from there, it was just a mad scramble. I mean, we had a lot of good advice from our colleagues at the AFL-CIO and from other colleagues throughout the labor bar on how to prepare. And there was, you know, a little bit of a debate about whether to use a lawyer who practices regularly in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, or whether to kind of keep it among labor lawyers. And for a variety of reasons, we decided to keep it among labor lawyers. And it had been a case that I had been working on for 5 years. And even then, you know, I wasn't sure I was totally up for the task, because obviously we have a hostile court these days, but I had a lot of great support from my colleagues at my firm. And we also partnered with the Stanford Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, which is a great group of folks out of Stanford that does public interest litigation at the Supreme Court. So I think we put together a good argument with all those resources.
You know, hearing you, I'm shaken just thinking that standing before those nine justices arguing this case. Can you stay with us? I got to talk about that moment in your life. That had to be a game changer. Right. Joining us on our live line right now is attorney Darren Dalmut, and we're talking about a case, Teamsters Local 174 versus Glacier Northwest. The arguments have been made. We'll talk about those arguments and when we're going to find out the results, which will probably be sometime in June. Back in a few minutes, you're listening to America's Workforce.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans, and we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers, and we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Ironworkers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 ironworkers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union ironworkers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our ironworkers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at uaw.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, here's what you do. Just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings. So please, keep them coming. Let's go back to Seattle, Washington. And joining us on our live line right now is Darren Dalmut, U.S. attorney. An attorney that argued a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. We're talking about the Glacier Northwest, Inc. versus Teamsters Local 174. 174 is based in Seattle, and this is a group of concrete drivers. And this is a case that actually started back in 2017. Darren told us in the first segment, didn't think it was going to go to the Supreme Court, but there's a lot of people watching this case right now. Now, they decided to go for it back in October. The case was argued in January. Darren, talk to me about that moment, the day you went there facing those nine justices. Well, my gosh, what went through your mind, and how did things go that day? What was your read on the justices?
So it's frankly harder to get a read than I expected, and that's because many of the justices didn't ask any questions at all. Justice Alito didn't ask any questions. Justice Kavanaugh didn't ask any questions. Justice Gorsuch didn't ask me any questions. He asked the other side a softball, and Justice Barrett asked only one or two questions, and again, I think not to me. So I ended up speaking primarily with most of the justices who were Democratic appointees and deemed liberal by the general media, although I ended up having to spend most of my time, I think, explaining very basic aspects of the case, basic facts that were in the complaint, and basic things about what unions do. I take that to, I'm not sure exactly how to read that. One read might be that the conservative justices are so hostile that they couldn't even be bothered to engage on the substance of what was going on, or that they've already had their minds made up. Or it could be that the case was more complicated than they initially thought, given some of the posture of it, because the labor board has actually issued a complaint on our unfair labor practice charges. And so you've got kind of parallel things going on here. And that does reinforce our view that this has always been a labor dispute and not a proper dispute for the state courts to tort claims, which are basically actions for damages, that it should be held by the labor board, which has always been our view of it. So, so that's at least a beginning of an answer.
So what's at stake here, Darren? I'm hearing the right to strike. I mean, if it goes against the Teamsters, and I tell you, I mean, with the conservative majority of 6-3, you got to think along those lines. I mean, I go back to the Janus decision back in 2018. We kind of saw that one coming. Obviously, if it goes that way, are we talking about unions that are probably going to say, maybe we shouldn't strike? We have a right to strike, but then again, with a decision like this, what's going to happen to our union? Are they going to bankrupt us? You see where I'm going with this? What are the possibilities here in your estimation?
Sure. I've had many people tell me that this is the most important case for private sector unions in decades. I hope that's not true, but many people have taken that view. And the reason that they've taken that view, I think, is along the lines that you say, that in plain talk, what's at stake is the ability of employers to impose costs, financial costs, on unions for going to strike whenever those strikes have the kind of inevitable effects that strikes have, namely that they cost companies business. And of course, the reason that people go on strike is to impose those economic consequences on folks in order to drive a resolution. So it's inherent in the very notion of striking that there will be those costs. And traditionally, that's been seen by the courts as an important part of the dispute resolution process. And there's been a recognition that each side has economic weapons that it can use freely. And so if this court goes the wrong way on this case, they'll put a massive thumb on the scale in favor of employers, and they'll tilt the use of those economic weapons in favor of employers. Now, so that's the big picture. I mean, the smaller picture, the more looking into the legalities, is we're still at the very beginning of the case, and kind of the worst that the the court can say is, well, we've got to prove it on the facts. We've got to prove on the facts that this is truly a labor dispute and that our drivers did take reasonable precautions to avoid gratuitous harm to the employer's property, in this case, the mixer trucks themselves. And so it could end up being a nothing burger at the end of the day, that if they send us back down to state court and we present the very same facts that we presented to the labor board and then dismissal is appropriate, like all it will end up meaning is that unions have to spend more on labor lawyers and get a little bit further in litigation. And while that's, you know, an annoyance and an unnecessary cost, I think the history of working people in this country is that courts have never been terribly friendly to the exercise of economic power. And, you know, working people have always figured out ways to engage in solidarity and to find ways to win sort of despite the law, not because of the law. And so in that sense, there's kind of nothing new here that throwing up additional legal hurdles to worker power is something that unions are used to navigating because they've had to do it before the NLRA, they've had to do it throughout the NLRA, and you know, that's what we know how to do as a movement.
Yeah, since the beginning of unions. Yeah, there's a history there. How do you feel Glacier's attorneys did? You mentioned that, what was it, an ex-Trump solicitor general or something? Did they make a decent case, in your opinion?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, in the sense that Mr. Francisco knows how to speak to the heartstrings of the conservative justices, and so he threw a lot of red meat to them, things like gratuitously bashing administrative agencies in general, you know, giving swan songs to property rights, things like this that the conservative justices really care about. But if you analyze his argument just on a purely legal basis, I mean, I think none of his arguments hold water and or are intellectually coherent. But, you know, as we've seen in so many cases in recent years, that may or may not make a big difference with this court. So I guess we'll find out in a few months.
Yeah, really. And that's what you're supposed to concentrate on, the legality of the case. You know, forget all the other spurious information that somehow gets in there. And like you said, throw in the red meat. We don't need that. Let's just concentrate on the facts of the case and go from there. Your relationship with the 174, now that this has come and gone, well, for now anyway, everything good? I know you're the secretary treasurer of the union. Rick Hicks was there with you. How do they feel about everything right now?
Well, I think they feel good about the argument that we presented. They feel like we, as a group, you know, gave a strong voice for labor and working people, and, you know, we're fierce advocates, and that we did everything we could to make it difficult for the justices to go where they probably want to go. So, you know, we've got a good working relationship with Local 174, and I hope we'll continue to represent them for years.
There you go. Well, Darren, I appreciate you coming to the table today to talk about this very, very important case. Very important case. Probably June. Is that when you see a decision coming out then?
Yeah, that's when the term ends. The court usually releases all its decisions by the end of June. They've been kind of historically slow this term, and but they could issue a decision any point in time between now and the end of June, but June would be the latest.
Glacier Northwest, Inc. versus Teamsters Local 174. Well, Darren, thank you again for joining us. Anybody else calling you and saying, hey, I got a case, I want you to go to the Supreme Court? That hasn't happened yet?
Not yet, but I will say I've been, it's been such a pleasure to hear from my colleagues throughout the labor movement in the wake of this. And I think a lot of people have reached out to recognize, you know, just what a big deal this is for our movement. And we've had so much support from people throughout the movement. So, you know, certainly if there is another case on the docket, you know, our firm would be happy to help out and to continue to build labor power. But in the meantime, I hope that we're able to stay away from the court for a good while.
Well, the Teamsters are lucky to have you, and all of labor is lucky to have you. And it's not too often that I talk to somebody that argued a case before the Supreme Court, especially with such significance as this. So thank you so much for joining us. Keep in touch. I'm sure we'll talk once this is all said and done. Okay, brother?
It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for all your work.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pat Gallagher on behalf of the North Coast Labor Federation.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers. Standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland at 216-881-1802. Call Music Talent of Cleveland as your dependable source for professional musicians in Northeast Ohio. Union musicians add harmony to weddings, elegance to parties, and uplifting music for all events. Music Talent of Cleveland contracts solo and ensemble musicians as well as bands and orchestras for single engagements. So hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland today. 216-881-1802.
Hi, this is Liz Schuler, president of the AFL-CIO, and I am a huge fan of Flash and America's Workforce Radio and podcast.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, always connecting people with employment, good employment. You can find more at ulagency.org. Let's go to line number two. And welcome back to the show, Mr. Pat Gallagher. Now, this month was supposed to be the last month for Pat. He was supposed to retire at the end of March. But I guess that's a moving target. What's the story here, Mr. Gallagher?
Well, we're trying to tie up some loose ends and take care of some things and make sure the members are all taken care of before I depart here. So it's still kind of a moving target and still shooting for some time this year. So
Okay. Well, I know you got some people that are supposed to replace you on the show here, but those are big shoes to fill. I appreciate what you brought to the table. How many years for you at the Steelworkers, by the way?
Well, I've been 27 years on staff, and I've been a steelworker for it would have been 47 in July if I make it that long. So.
Wow, that's a long time. Okay. Well, let's start off with some good news. I mentioned at the top of the show that Michigan is very close to repealing right to work. And here's a state that went right to work in the middle of the night over a decade ago. Pat, this is really groundbreaking. Maybe you can add to the conversation here. Go ahead.
No, this is great news. It's really something that we need to do. It's one of the first states ever to repeal right to work. And I just want to make it clear to the listeners that I'm not a Michigan fan, but I've got to applaud the people in Michigan for what they've done here. This is just, this is historic and groundbreaking work, and hopefully it'll start a movement across the country. On Tuesday, the Michigan State Senate voted on Senate Bill 34, which eliminated right to work in the private sector. They also voted on Senate Bill 6, which was to restore prevailing wage in the state of Michigan, two major labor issues. And those issues now are going to go to the House for what they call reconciliation. Now, each state legislator and also our congressional, our federal legislator, they have one house, one part of the legislature passes a bill, it's got to go to the other house, what they call reconciliation, so they can get the same bill passed and it gets forward. So that's the step they are now. The House has already passed this bill in a different format. They're just working out the details to make sure they're in conjunction and the same bill goes forward to the governor's desk. And she's expected to sign it, and right to work will be done in Michigan.
Yeah, that's truly significant. And you know what I like about this? The Washington Post picked up on this story yesterday. So when you got national news media covering this, that sends a message to a number of states. Because I know Montana is still trying to go right to work, and they had a big protest on that last week, I believe. So we're going to stay on these issues, but it's all good news. Yeah, Ryan Day's got to get his act together here, because I don't like those two losses in a row from Michigan. So we'll see what happens.
Well, we're gonna lay off them for a little while because of the great work they're doing getting this right to work repealed and all that. And I heard that the target date is next week, the 21st, try to get the bill signed. So don't know if that'll come to fruition or not, but that's the target date they have. It's great news. It's really, hopefully it starts a trend in our country that people start realizing how damaging a right to work is to not only the union workers, but to every worker, how it suppresses wages and keeps us down. And I think it's something that we need, takes away our rights. It's something that needs to be repealed across the country.
That's why we call it Right to Work for Less. That's what it's all about. Some good news regarding casinos. What can you share with us, Pat?
Yeah, you know, in Ohio, we have the four casinos that are full gambling casinos. And Penn National casinos in Toledo and Columbus, and United Steelworkers and United Auto Workers have a coalition that represents the workers. And on February 13th, the workers there ratified a four-year, four-month contract that had significant wage increases and straightened out a lot of the scheduling issues and bidding issues and seniority issues that prevail in the casinos. Casinos are it's a very different type of animal. I mean, how they treat their employees, it's a lot of different type of scheduling problems and a lot of nuances that we need to fix to get people a decent quality of life. Also, too, there's the difference between the tipped employees and the non-tipped employees, and there's all kind of where the tipped employees only when they're not working in a tipped position, they only receive $5, $6 an hour compensation, depending on their class. So there's a lot of injustice there and all that. And even the casino was putting out trying to hire people, and they were putting out that, you know, our members were making $25 an hour, $30 an hour, but that's based on tips, and so people would go in there and sit at a table game at a blackjack table, says, I'm not tipping you, you make $25 an hour.
Right.
They didn't explain to them that the $25 an hour is including all the tips that they get. That's the only reason they make any money. They only make $5, $6 an hour, you know, when they're not being in tip status.
Yeah. And keep this in mind, if somebody's losing at that blackjack table, those tips aren't going to be coming, will they?
No, they won't be. So, yeah, we got the non-tipped employees got a 4.5% wage increase retroactive December 1st, 2022. The tipped employees got a $1 an hour wage increase plus 2% on their wages that also went into effect December 1st, 2022. There's wage increases scheduled throughout the contract. It's we also did some things on the holiday scheduling and the job bidding and seniority and vacation scheduling and issues like that were really a concern to our members. I think we got a pretty fair agreement, and hopefully we can keep making strides forward and try to get our members their rights that they deserve in the casino industry.
All right, let's switch to a rail. I know all eyes are on East Palestine, Ohio, and also Norfolk Southern. And I know the Attorney General in the state of Ohio is filing suit against Norfolk Southern because, well, right now, from what I've been reading, this mishap, this derailment was 100% preventable because the bearings overheated and caused that derailment. I know you've been following this. I'm just wondering, what's your take on legislation that's going to make a difference? I know Sherrod Brown has got some bipartisan legislation on the table. What are you hearing right now, Pat?
Well, actually, you know, I mean, we got to look back at the railroad industry and all. I mean, they've made some technological changes to some of the, you know, to the engines, to the cars and all that. And they use that to eliminate crews. At one time, a crew had like five members in a crew. There was a fireman, there was a conductor, there was an engineer, there was a trainman. And they all worked together in cohesion to try to make sure of safety. Everything was safe in that. Slowly but surely, they've cut that down to two men crews. In some cases, just one man, just an engineer running an engine, and that's been a real problem. There's been no safety, and they've got a certain amount of time to make inspections because and they're don't have enough time to do proper inspections. And I think that contributed to the East Palestine tragedy because the railway workers did not have enough time, and there's not enough safety requirements for them. That they have to go and have the time to actually perform the audits, perform the jobs on these trains before they're moving. So there's some good legislation going on. I know Sherrod Brown and I guess J.D. Vance is also co-sponsoring too to make sure that there's a minimum two-man crews to make sure that they have the opportunity to perform all the safety checks that they have to before these trains are in operation.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about this story for a long time, and I feel bad for the people in that area because I know a lot of them would like to get out of there, but they can't right now because their property values have declined dramatically since that derailment. One more here regarding steel, and I saw this yesterday. The International Trade Commission released a report on the economic impact of the Section 232 tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, and I know you've been following this story over the years, and it's important that we preserve the jobs, and tariffs have been very, very positive in going in that direction. What can you tell us about this?
Well, the International Trade Commission is kind of downplaying the effect of the 232, what it has on preserving industry and maintaining prices and that. It's, they do that because they want to just dump, have the right to unilaterally dump steel across the world from different nations, and so that's something that we disagree with. All that, the 232 has been very effective. It's kept dumped products out of our country, and it's allowed the steel industry to regroup and reinvest and start making domestic steel again. We need steel in America. We need steel for defense. Number one, that's the number one. I mean, we know what's going on in Ukraine. We know how it's important to have a strong military and a strong defense of infrastructure, and steel is a very important part of that. So we need to make sure that we maintain our ability to make steel in this country and provide the products out there. And steel is still one of the most used commodities in our world today right now. It's in everything you look at, there's some kind of steel involved. So it's very important we maintain our ability to make this product in our country.
Yeah, the Alliance for American Manufacturing, which is one of our sponsors on the show, and they're aligned with the steelworkers, they came out with some polling on this, and they found that 76% of voters, I mean, that's a lot, 76% of voters agree that the U.S. should continue to impose those Section 301 tariffs, especially on these Chinese imports. We want to keep the jobs here. I mean, that's what it's all about.
If we continue to let them violate the rules and go on there unfeathered, I mean, they're just going to continue dumping. We could have the crisis that we had back in the early 2000s when over 50 steel companies filed bankruptcy. So
exactly.
We want to prevent that from happening again.
Yeah, we don't want to go down that road again. Nope.
Flash, I lived that once. I don't want to have to live that again.
All right, Mr. Gallagher, we'll wrap it up on that note. Pat Gallagher on behalf of the North Coast Labor Federation. That'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, we'll check in with the American Legion and the Alliance for Retired Americans. Until then, all of you have a wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.